settling in, let me ask you another question. What was the surprise at the barbecue?
African
drums. Oh, great. Wonderful. Another question. We're going to distinguish pretty soon between a general dynamical system, which sort of looks like this, and a Hamiltonian system, which looks like that. Aside from this difference in looks, what special properties does a Hamiltonian system have? I remember I asked this to my applied math teacher when I was a graduate student, and he didn't have a clue. Okay, we will have an answer for you in a little bit. Let me go on from here. I want to derive the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. That is the statement that if you wait long enough for a Hamiltonian system, after a while it will settle into a behavior in which the probability of having the values of the p's and q's will be proportional to an exponential of the Hamiltonian divided by some number normalized with a 1 over z. As a first step, I want to derive the Liouville equation. That is an equation for the time derivative of the probability function. Starting from the Hamiltonian mechanics, Hamiltonian mechanics is the statement that the problem is described by p's and q's. The derivative of a q with respect to t is the partial derivative of a Hamiltonian with respect to the momentum variable. And the derivative of the momentum variable with respect to time is the partial derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the corresponding coordinate variable. Now, in general, a definition of a probability density in Hamiltonian mechanics is that if we want any function of the p's and q's, we want to take its average at time t. That's an integral over all the p's and q's of that function times the probability density. I'm going to start out, instead of deriving directly an equation for the time derivative of rho from the Hamiltonian, I'm going to start out by doing something far more general, talking about a general dynamical system, which is described by a variable or a vector set of variables, x of at time t, in which the time derivative of x is given by some function v of x of t and t. This is then the most general first order set of differential equations you could write down. If you think of x of t as a vector of variables, x1, x2, x3, it is very, very general indeed. We will then define a probability density, probability of getting the value capital X, of having the value small x. That probability density will define to be rho of x and t, and that definition will mean that the average of any function of capital X at time t will be the integral over small x of g of x times rho of x and t. This, as I said, is a definition of the probability density. Here, capital X is a dynamical variable, like maybe somebody's weight, and X is the value of that variable, like 13.2 pounds, something which you might measure on a scale. So I said I'm going to do something with much simpler formulas. I'm going to imagine solving the dynamical systems problem in which there's a differential equation in which the time derivative of capital X with respect to time is some function of capital X, and that function can depend also on time. I imagine solving that to get a solution, X of t. I will have a probability function in which rho of X of t times dx is the probability that the solution will be in the interval dx about the point x. This is we're dealing with a probability because when we start out at time t equals 0, In fact, we start out with a system in which we describe things by probabilities. For example, we have a population. Capital X is the weight of the bunch of people in the population, X1, X2, X3, for person 1, 2, 3. And we get a probability distribution. There's a probability that people will have a weight between 100 and 101 pounds, and 101 and 102 pounds, and so forth. But if we start out with a probability distribution, it was likely that the solution at a later time will have a probability distribution in it. Question is, what's the time dependent? So the probability distribution. Now, it's a pain in the neck to calculate the time dependence of the probability distribution directly. That's because the probability distribution has funny properties because it isn't really a physical quantity. Instead, the physical quantity is rho of x and t dx. Rho of x and t has funny transformation properties in time because dx has funny transformation properties in time. And I can never figure out, at least when I was a student, I could never figure out what the derivative of dx meant. That was sort of a mystery to me. So I'm not going to deal directly with the derivative of dx. Instead, what I'm going to do is talk about calculating a physical quantity, which is the average of g, and then using that physical quantity calculate how the probability distribution changes in time. X of t itself changes in a very simple way. At time t plus dt, where dt is an infinitesimal, x of t plus dt is x, which you started out with at time t, plus the v, which we call the velocity, at as a function of x and t, times dt. We're going to use this formula to calculate the time dependence of the probability distribution and go on from there. Okay, the average of some function of x at the time t plus dt is going to be given by the integral dx, g of x plus dt times v of x t times rho of x and t. This says that we take the values that we get at a time t and move them forward through the amount of time dt to get the probability distribution for the values at the later time. That is identical then to the value of the integral of g of x times rho of x t plus dt, which is the definition of what the average of g of x is at the later time t plus dt. This formula is not trivial, but it is relatively simple. And it is then the definition of what it means to calculate an average at a later time. We will start out from that formula. I'm going to spend a moment for you to look at it. Carry exactly that result forward onto the next slide. This is just a copying from the last slide. And now the rest is arithmetic, or rather calculus, but that calculus is our arithmetic. What we're going to do is take a first derivative and expand this in dt. We will then look at the terms proportional to dt and get from that looking an equation of motion for the probability distribution. So we start here. And we expand. Here, we take the partial derivative with respect to time times of rho of x and t dt. That's what this thing is here. And we can, since everything is nice and smooth and convergent, we can differentiate underneath the integral sign. This, if I want to put on my hat as a mathematician for a moment, this requires a sufficiently smooth G and a sufficiently smooth probability distribution. But please assume that everything is smooth enough so we can get away with these operations. On the right-hand side of this formula, to get another representation for this time derivative, we then expand this G in the dt that is there. We say that we're at a later time dt. X has changed by a certain amount. And what we get is the partial derivative of a G with respect to X times dt times the velocity, which is the rate of change of X in time. We again do that underneath the integral sign. And we now have a right-hand side and a left-hand side of our equation. We can cancel out the blue stuff between right and left, because it's the same. We can cancel out the red stuff then between right and left, because it's the same. And we are left with only the black stuff, which we move to the left-hand side of the equation and get the integral dx, g of x, times the time derivative of rho, starting from there, minus the integral dx, v of x and t, times the x derivative of g, times rho. Now we do one more step, which is an integration by parts. We assume that the integrals converge well enough at plus and minus infinity. We then integrate by parts and move this dx to act on v and rho. There it is right there. And we have now isolated dg. We have isolated, g here. And what we have is the integral dx times g of x times this bracket of stuff in blue. Now, g of x is any old function we want to calculate. We want to calculate the average of. We assumed it was sort of smooth, and we will then continue it in that assumption. But otherwise, g is arbitrary. If g is arbitrary, then the only way we can make this integral vanish always is to make the stuff inside the curly bracket vanish. We then end up with an equation, dt of rho plus the partial derivative with respect to x of the product of v and rho is equal to 0. I wrote that down here with now tons and tons of coordinates. I'm thinking tons and tons of different x's. I'm thinking of x as a vector with hundreds of components, or maybe with only one component. But I'm writing down this equation with all of those components. The time derivative of the probability of observing a value of capital X, having the value small x at time t, is rho itself times now calculating this derivative applied to v here. This is the sum over j of the derivative with respect to each and every one of the x's of the jth component of v. The jth component of v means that's the velocity describing how xj changes. And then we have a second term, which is vj times the derivative with respect to xj of rho. These are now the two terms you get by differentiating these two terms inside of here. This term is called the divergence term. It describes the dilation, the growth, or the shrinking of the dx. What dx? This dx. It describes the growth and shrinking of that dx as time goes on. It describes the thing that always confused me when I saw derivation of these equations. Rho then has two terms. One comes from the dilation of dx, and the other comes from the fact that v is moving, that v describes the motion of x. This then gives the general description of how a probability distribution described by a first order differential equation in time changes in time. Let me read what I said, see if there's anything I left out. Nope, nothing I left out. It's all in the notes. You can change this around a tiny, tiny bit, but not much. And if you want to see it done differently, it's in Wikipedia. Okay, now we continue the calculation. The Hamiltonian case is special. There are two kinds of coordinates in the Hamiltonian case, two kinds of x's. There's an x equal to q, and there's an x equal to p. And there are lots of p's and lots of q's. And then we have to rewrite the equation for a row that depends on p's and q's. We get two terms. One term is, first I'm going to calculate this divergence term. The divergence term is easy. The derivative of the velocity that goes with the momentum is the velocity that goes with the momentum is equal to d by dq of the Hamiltonian. I'm supposed to take the p derivative of the velocity that goes with respect with, I'm supposed to take the q derivative of the velocity which goes with the momentum, and I get something like this. The velocity that goes with the q is the derivative of p of the Hamiltonian. That's let me start again, because I got myself confused. There are two kinds of coordinates, q and p. The x's that are called q have a velocity which is the derivative with respect to p of the Hamiltonian, and that's written down right there. I then, from this expression, take the derivative with respect to q of that. Then there are coordinates called p. These have a time derivative which is minus the derivative with respect to q of the Hamiltonian. So I write that down there. And then I'm supposed to take the derivative with respect to p of that. However, you can see that these expressions are just the same except for a change in order of q and p. One of the things that we learn in calculus is that you can almost always, essentially always, change the order of differentiation with respect to two different things. So the derivative with respect to q, then the derivative with respect to p is the same as the derivative with respect to p, and then the derivative with respect to q. So this whole thing is equal to zero. This result, called Liouville's theorem, is the statement that this dilation term is simply zero in classical mechanics. This is a deep and interesting result, which is very special for classical mechanics. It's not true for a general dynamical system. In a general dynamical system, we have a growth or decay of the dx term, and that changes the form of the equation for the probability distribution. In any case, we now have that in Hamiltonian mechanics, leaving out this dilation term, the time derivative of the probability density is given by the following thing. We look at the time derivative of p, and that gives us minus the derivative with respect to q of h. And we then take the derivative with respect to p of rho. We look at the derivative with respect to q. That gives us the derivative with respect to p of h. That's the time derivative of q. And then we take the derivative with respect to q of rho. This summed over all the possible terms gives us the total time derivative, or the time derivative of the probability density. Now, this looks like the same kind of thing as we would get if we took the time derivative of any function of p and q. The time derivative of any function of p and q changes because q changes, then we have, as q changes, we have the... Yes. As q changes, the derivative with respect to x gives us the derivative with respect to p of the Hamiltonian. As p changes, the derivative with respect to p of x gives minus the derivative with respect to q of the Hamiltonian. You might notice that the sign of these two terms, or these two terms look exactly alike, the sign is in fact different. Here this thing appears on the left-hand side of the equation. Here it appears on the right-hand side of the equation. Therefore, the sign of what you're doing on the two cases is different. But that's just the way it should be. In fact, rho changes opposite to the way x changes. Changes in rho make up for changes in x. Now, you all remember, I suspect, from your fancy classical mechanics course, how this is described. It is described in terms of a Poisson bracket. A Poisson bracket is usually written with these curly brackets. It is defined so that the Poisson bracket of f and g is the sum over alpha df dq times dg dp, f and g we're thinking of as a function of q and p, minus the derivative and the derivatives in the opposite order. Therefore, the time derivative of rho, if you look back at the last slide, is the Poisson bracket of h with respect to rho, and the time derivative of x is the Poisson bracket of x with h. This and this are backward with respect to each other, and because of this minus sign, if you write a Poisson bracket backwards, you get minus the bracket. That is, the bracket of f and g is minus the bracket of g and f. In fact, Poisson brackets show two very important identities. They are antisymmetrical, that's this thing, and there is this thing, which is, as I recall, called the Jacobi identity. That is, the Poisson bracket of f and g bracketed with h plus the same thing done with cyclic permutations after you do the cyclic permutations and add it all up, you get zero. It is interesting and non-trivial to notice that the same relations are true for operators in quantum theory, except that in quantum theory, these curly brackets, which are Poisson brackets, are replaced by these square brackets, that is, they're replaced by commutators. The bracket relations for classical time dependence are just the same as the bracket relations for quantum mechanics, except that the brackets have different definitions. Therefore, this classical mechanics and quantum mechanics have an extremely deep connection with one another, and that deep connection is mostly, but only partially, understood to this very day. I remind you again about the difference in sign between this and this. Questions or comments? I'm sorry, I didn't understand your words.
If possible, can you go further into the connection between the two? It's mostly understood today.
I still didn't understand. Maybe I don't have my hearing aids in today, but on the other hand, I don't usually get much benefit from them. So speak.
Okay, if possible, could
yes?
you go deeper into the relationship?
Oh, okay, thank you. I understand. You have a different regional accent from mine, that's why. Okay. The comment, the question was, if possible, could I go deeper into the relation between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. Yes, I can. Only a little bit deeper, however. They are extremely different. Classical mechanics describes what must happen. It is said to be deterministic. If I tell you the particle's initial positions of momentum, I can then find out, in principle, at a later time, all about where the particles are, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts, no probabilities, nothing like that. They will be there, period. Quantum mechanics deals in probabilities. A wave function squared is a probability that something will happen. You start out with a wave function. You develop the wave function in time. So what you're talking about is how the probability develops in time. Despite the fact that the descriptions of the two theories are absolutely and entirely different, we know that in some sense, as h bar goes to zero, the curly brackets give us the same results as the square brackets, that is, classical mechanics goes into. Classical mechanics goes into, I should do it in the opposite order. Quantum mechanics goes into classical mechanics. That's true, but we don't know exactly. We can go through various cases. We can look at detail of how the harmonic oscillator does this, that, and the next thing. The Heisenberg equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator are identical classically and quantum mechanically, despite the fact that the description in terms of probabilities in one case and certainties in another is entirely different. We can go through it all, but basically we do not very well understand the relationship between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. What does it mean that the world is described in probabilistic terms? How do we understand that? Quantum mechanics, in the classical Copenhagen view, is, that is, the theory of quantum mechanics was defined by people working in Copenhagen in the 1920s and 30s under the direction of Niels Bohr. Quantum mechanics in the classical Copenhagen view is a subject which is understood in terms of measurement theory. That is, in terms of what it is to look at this stick and say that the stick is at a given angle. However, measurement theory is only describable in terms of classical mechanics. Therefore, quantum mechanics is in some sense defined in terms of classical mechanics, in terms of the in the Copenhagen description. That is almost impossible to get your mind around. Very, very hard. There is a book out there entitled The Age of Entanglement by Louise Gilder, which describes in that many pages, well, it's actually only half the book that does that, but describes how people tried to get their mind around it and didn't actually succeed 100%. The long and the short of it is that the standard way of understanding quantum mechanics is in terms of classical mechanics. These two things are entirely different, and we do not fully understand how they fit together. I said in many, many different words that we don't fully understand. Okay, may I go on? Okay. Forward. Liouville's theorem is the statement which I just made, which is that the volume element, the dilation of the volume element is zero. I've just proved it. So that this Liouville's theorem is the statement the volume elements in phase space are conserved in the course of a motion in quantum mechanics. Imagine we have a phase space, P and Q. This might be a huge space with hundreds of dimensions, since there might be hundreds of P's and Q's. However, I will put it on the blackboard because I can't do any better than that. And it is only easy to visualize in two dimensions. Imagine that I start out with, as it says here, with a probability which is non-zero in some little volume in this space. And then time goes on. The P's and Q's change in time, and they change, this is classical mechanics, they change in a deterministic way. Maybe what comes out looks like this, and you get something that happens like this. So this is T equals 0, this is T equals 7, and this volume goes into that volume. The Liouville's theorem states that these two areas, or more generally volumes, are the same. The total area, the shaded area here, is the same as the total shaded area there. Indeed, then, by thinking about it a little more, you could recognize that if the probability distribution, the probability density, were constant in this area, it would then remain constant in that area. And that's a deep, deep fact. That's what this says here. The Liouville's theorem is a statement that volume elements in phase space are conserved in the course of a motion. That's a consequence of the vanishing divergence term. So if you start out with a probability distribution at time zero and have that function be non-zero in some region of phase space, of volume omega of 0. After a time, this probability density will progress to occupy a different region, progress from there to there. According to Liouville's theorem, the volumes, here shown as areas, the volumes of the regions before and after will be unchanged. Omega of t is omega of 0. Then this says again that if the probability density were constant within here, it would turn out to be constant within there. I've now said it twice. It's deep. It's hard. You have to think about it. There is another consequence. So one special consequence of classical mechanics is Liouville's theorem, Liouville. That's represented by this special form for the time dependence of the probability distribution, that special form with no dilation term. It is also true that if you calculate in a situation in which the Hamiltonian is a function of P and Q but has no time dependence, that is P squared over 2m perhaps plus V of Q, but not V of Q and T, that's not allowed, V of Q. If you calculate in a situation in which you just have a Hamiltonian with no time dependence, then it is also equally true that the time derivative of the Hamiltonian, like any other thing, is going to have its time dependence given by the Poisson bracket of H with H. Oh gosh, I didn't have to get the sign right here, because it's this H with H and it's zero. That's good, because I can never remember the sign here. And so the time derivative of the Hamiltonian in this case is equal to zero, so that we have automatically, whenever we have a time-independent Hamiltonian, we whenever we have no explicit time dependence in the Hamiltonian, the total energy as represented by the Hamiltonian does not change in time. That's good. We sort of knew that there was an energy conservation law. But now we know something else that we didn't know before. Imagine that we had rho, which depends on P and Q, being any function of the Hamiltonian. Imagine that probability density were equal to e to the minus beta h over z, or equal to maybe to h squared divided by something else divided by y. In either of these two cases, rho is going to be unchanging in time. That's because the time derivative of rho with respect to time is given by this relationship. And if rho is a function of h, you get d rho dh times the h dq here, and you get from this term d rho dh times dh dp there, and you get full cancellation. So if rho is any function of the Hamiltonian, then you get the same functional form for all times. We are looking for a situation in which we have something simple to say about equilibrium. How do we know that we're looking for something simple to say about equilibrium? Well, if we were Boltzmann working in the 1870s, we would know that Maxwell said that in equilibrium you get something that looks like this out. That's a simple result, something that looks like the e to the minus beta h. That's a simple result, and you would be looking around for a simple result. Boltzmann then understood that he wanted a simple result for equilibrium. Now, being a physicist is having a deep intuition about the world, or at least it's very helpful to have a deep intuition about the world. Boltzmann knew this stuff about rho. He didn't know it in quite this language. This language had partially been developed by Hamilton. This is Hamiltonian mechanics, and Hamilton is an earlier figure, 1830s, I think. In any case, this had been developed by Hamilton. Boltzmann knew this, and Boltzmann had a tremendous intuition. Boltzmann then said that this implied that you would that this e to the minus beta h form was very general. In fact, Maxwell more or less said that this form e to the minus beta h would apply only if you had H is P squared over 2M. That is, that's the only case that Maxwell really looked at. Boltzmann understood that this would equally well apply to almost everything. If you just waited long enough with any isolated system, you would, according to Boltzmann, get this e to the minus beta H form. That was a wonderful result, involved a wonderful piece of intuition. Now, exactly why it's e to the minus beta H should not be clear at this point. Classical mechanics is not enough to specify a unique equilibrium probability distribution. It could equally well be probability is H squared divided by something or other, or H to the ninth power, or maybe different for different systems. Something else is needed in addition in order to get this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. From what we have said so far, from this equation, any function of H for rho will do. I've already said that, but it says that on the next slide. We could have any old function of rho, and in fact, people do use different functions of rho. We can use different functions of H for different purposes. In your previous statistical mechanics course, people probably made a big deal out of the different kinds of distributions you could use to calculate different things in different situations. In fact, there are three different distributions called ensembles that you use to calculate in different situations to calculate equilibrium properties. We've been talking almost entirely about what is called the canonical ensemble. This canonical ensemble, canonical is a funny word. Canonical is used to represent the standard or usual thing. Canon law is the usual law of the church, not law produced by guns, but the usual accepted law of the church. Canonical ensemble is the usual ensemble. It is rho of P and Q is e to the minus beta H of P and Q divided by Z. It assumes a fixed number of particles. If there are several kinds of particles, the number of particles of each kind is fixed. This is the right ensemble to use if you have a system in which you have a system which is weakly coupled to a larger system around it. This could be used for essentially any large system, and a small system in which the energy only goes back weakly with the system around it. It says that better here. This is the right ensemble to use if a small system with a known number of particles is weakly coupled to a larger system so that it might exchange energy but not particles with a larger system. This is okay to use if there are no other important conserved variables besides the ones mentioned. If you have a system in motion, you have to do something different. If you have a system which is rotating around, watch out for the rotation. You have to use something different because the angular momentum has to be included. People also use what is called the microcanonical ensemble. This is a situation in which the number of particles and the energy is fixed. Then rho is the delta function of E minus H divided by another constant. That constant is represented as chi of E, and it's called the structure factor. This is the right ensemble to use if the energy and the number of particles in a small system is unknown. this is okay to use once again if there are no other important conserved variables. There is a third ensemble which is in general use. It is called the grand canonical ensemble. This one was invented by Gibbs. It takes a situation in which the number of particles is not fixed, is not known. If you have a small system exchanging particles sort of weakly with the world around it, you use rho as an exponential of beta H minus a chemical potential, that's another constant like temperature, times N, and you divide it by some symbol which is generally written that way, and I've forgotten the name of it. What's the name of that symbol? It's called, it's the name of the cascade particle, but I don't remember the name of the symbol. Okay, it doesn't matter. This is the right ensemble to use if a small system is weakly coupled to a larger system, so it might exchange energy and particles with a larger system. This is okay to use if there are no other important conserved variables besides the ones mentioned. If you have any large system, it's okay to use any one of these three ensembles. Any huge system with no other important conserved variables, you can use any one of these three ensembles because, in fact, the fluctuations in number are small here, and energy are small in the canonical ensemble. It is just as if you fixed the energy and the number of particles to a first approximation. Fluctuations in general for large systems are small for so-called extensive quantities, quantities which are summed over the entire system. Okay, this is John, I'm just saying it again. For the simplest case in which the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus u of r, for example, the Brownian particle, the result of the Hamiltonian mechanics is that the probability distribution has this time dependence. With a p over m, that's a derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p, and a gradient ru, that's the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to r. That is the time dependence. Rho being any function of the Hamiltonian will do. We have to, in order to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, bring some additional information to bear. Experimentally, we know from studying the Brownian particle or from Einstein's calculation, which I'm about to describe to you, we know that, in fact, the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is correct. However, from this much argument up to here, any function of the Hamiltonian will do. The Einstein model for Brownian motion is this, where dot, dot, dot might stand for additional terms coming from the Hamiltonian. For example, a term like that, or a term like that. We're going to study successively the effect of the Hamiltonian terms and the terms with the eta of t and the p over tau. We are going to study all of the effect of all of these terms on the probability distribution and see what comes out. Okay. So here's our plan of action. We're going to take the Einstein theory, which has terms generated by the Hamiltonian, and an eta of t, and a p over tau. We're going to take that and generate an equation of motion for the probability of observing a momentum p and a coordinate x at time t. We're going to write down an equation for that time derivative, and we expect and hope to see the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution come out. We know, in fact, that it does come out because we saw the argument for it in a different way. That argument in a different way says that p was a sum of the eta of t, or integral of eta of t, and an integration of a Gaussian random variables is a Gaussian random variable and produces an e to the minus beta p squared result. So we're going to study the time dependence using this time dependence of p, and we are going to expect that something nice and simple is going to come out. We'll start now. Let me read this and make sure I'm doing the right stuff. We'll start now with the friction term. We already know a lot about the friction term. This is something we already studied because it is a first-order differential term with a velocity of p and t being minus p over tau. We know what the effect of this term will be on the time derivative of rho. It is, in fact, minus the derivative of, with respect to p, of v times rho, which is then the derivative with respect to p of p over tau times rho, since v is minus p over tau. However, for the other term, eta of t, we can't just look up our old result. The reason we can't just look up the old result is that we have something funny going on with the eta of t. The eta of t, because the average of eta of t is equal to zero, because of this, the average first order effect of eta of t is zero, and we have to go to second order. The integral du of eta of u from t to t plus delta t, as we will see in a moment, is proportional to dt plus dt, is proportional to dt squared. It is, in fact, gamma times dt squared over 2. It is functionally Monday morning for me, and I'm not functioning properly. There's no square there. We might expect this to be squared, but it's not true. It is proportional to gamma times dt over 2. This average. Therefore, we're going to see a dt term from the square of something in the time dependence. So it is quite different from what happens from the case that we have studied before. In fact, this study of what happens to second order from a Gaussian random variable was one of the major 1905 contributions of Einstein. This result, we're going to see it come out, and it's going to give us something interesting. So now we're going to focus our attention on this Gaussian random variable, eta of t, and see how that affects the probability distribution, rho of p. I'm going to drop the q. We know how the q will enter. We'll put it back in at the last moment. But now we're just going to talk about the change in momentum that occurs because you have a random variable, eta of s, which goes between t and t plus delta t. And we're going to look at the effect of that change in momentum over a very short period of time. In fact, we're going to go back to our old calculation in terms of g of p, and then redo that calculation by looking at the change in momentum. I should mention to you that many students of theoretical science have gotten particularly interested in this kind of situation because Gaussian random variables not only show up in Brownian motion, they also show up in our best understanding of stock market behavior. The behavior of the logarithm of prices in various kinds of financial markets have that the logarithms of the prices change in a random fashion with a Gaussian random variable. So the calculation that we're about to do not only applies to a Brownian particle, but it applies to an idealized behavior of the stock market. But let me just continue. We have a change in momentum, delta P, produced between the time t and the time t plus delta t. Once again, we are doing the calculation of rho by saying that we're going to take some function of the momentum, g of p, integrate that function over p times a rho at t plus delta t, and that will give us the value of the average of g of p at the time t plus delta t. That is equally well going to be giving us the average of this function at p plus delta p. When this is the value of delta p, this is now gives us the change in momentum over the time delta t. This average times the probability at time t is equally well as the left-hand side of the equation. Both of them are equally well expressions for the average momentum, the function of the average momentum at time t plus delta t. Both this left-hand side and this right-hand side is an expression for that average momentum of the momentum at time t plus delta t. We will then calculate, as we calculated before, the result of doing expansions of this in delta t. But before we do that, we should shift the origin of integration here. The integral here goes from minus infinity to infinity. We can then replace the variable of integration by p minus delta p. That will move the delta p over to here, which is where I want to have it. So an equivalent expression to this is that this average of g at time t plus delta t is the integral with respect to p of g of p rho of p minus delta p and time t. Since g of p is arbitrary, we then can calculate the probability of observing the momentum p at time t plus delta t is the average. Average over what? Average over all the values of this Gaussian random variable is the average of rho of p minus delta p at time t. This is not, again, a trivial argument. However, it was followed in a step-by-step fashion here, and it is nothing very exciting has happened. So now we do the expansion using the result that there was on the last slide. I just recopied the result at the bottom of the last slide and the top of this one. And here it is with what the value of delta p is. So now we expand this right-hand side. The lowest order term in the expansion is the average of rho of p at time t. What are we averaging over? It's important to keep our eye on what we're averaging over. We're averaging over the values of eta between time t and t plus delta t. That's the only thing that we're averaging over. And that rho of p at time t doesn't depend on that. So we could throw away these averages and cancel out with that term. Next, we have the average of delta p times the derivative of rho with respect to p. The average of delta p is equal to zero because of that. So the average change in momentum is equal to zero. And then finally, we have the change in momentum squared, which is the second derivative with respect to p of the probability density of p and t. This factor of 1/2 is because there is a 1/2 in the usual formula for expanding. F of x is f of 0 plus x times f prime of x plus 1/2 f double prime of x times x squared over 2, this Taylor series expansion. These terms cancel. This term is 0. What we're left with is then going to be this term, which is the time derivative of rho of p at time t. And that times, when we move the delta t over to the other side of the equation, is this. The time derivative of rho is proportional to the change in p squared average divided by 2, divided by the delta t that came from expanding here, times the second derivative of rho with respect to p and t. Now we calculate the average of delta p squared. Delta p is this integral. What we get is two integrals to be performed, eta of u, eta of s, du, ds, between t and t plus delta t. This average is, by the property of Gaussian random variables, gamma times the delta function of the difference between these variables. And that delta function integrates over s to give us 1. So we integrate over u and get a delta t. And that's the result we have way over there. The delta t cancels against that delta t. And we end up with the equation that this eta of t term carried out to second order gives us gamma over 2 times the second derivative with respect to p of rho of p and t. This describes a diffusion in momentum space. Notice that because this is a diffusive result, this result cannot be followed backward in time. We can't turn the equation around and ask what happened before. It doesn't make much sense. In any case, we put the results together. The time derivative of rho comes from two terms. This term is a friction produced by the collisions with all of the molecules. That friction term has a dp times p over tau. I want you to notice that the dp is outside the square bracket. The dp differentiates everything. That's quite appropriate because we want the integral over all p of this time derivative to be 0. The integral over all p of this gives us results at p equals plus or minus infinity, and we assume that the probability density in those places is 0. This second derivative term, which is the term we just calculated from the second order effect of the random variable, that term is also integrated over p, gives us 0. And so both of these terms together have the right property. We can look at this and see what the time-independent result would be for rho. We can look and see what happens to rho after a very large period of time, assuming that these terms which might arise from a Hamiltonian stuff, dh dp times d by dp of rho minus dh dq times d by dq of rho, q being x here, that these terms are already canceled out. We can look at this and see what we might get as an equilibrium result. To get an equilibrium result, we write rho of p, x and t, is some exponential of p, q of p of x. This is an assumption that we don't have any time dependence after a long period of time. We then plug in. We find from this result second derivative of q with respect to p. We find from this result a p over tau. And there's a simple solution to this equation. Q is p squared over gamma tau plus c of x. Gamma, as you recall, is the result of this second order term. Tau, as you recall, is the friction term. And as you recall also, we had a result that we had thermodynamic equilibrium when gamma times 2, tau, is 2 times kT times the mass of the particle. So we would expect this to be 2 kT times the mass of the particle. We then have an integration term, a constant of integration, which depends on position. To get the usual Hamiltonian result, you write C of x, this integration term, is the potential divided by kT, and you end up with P squared over 2mkT plus U divided by kT. This is Einstein's result for the equilibrium probability distribution, now derived as a result of the time dependence of the probability. We have just a little bit more that we have to go through here. Our fullest time-dependent equation, including both Brownian motion and Hamiltonian mechanics, is. Here I wrote instead, this is the terms that come from the Hamiltonian. You would recognize this better if I wrote H of P, Q, and T, instead of energy of p, r, and t. But this is the energy of the particle with momentum p at the position r. The Hamiltonian term is the gradient of that energy times the gradient r of the probability density minus the gradient in r of the energy times the gradient of p of the probability density. This is what comes from Hamiltonian mechanics. This is what comes from the Einstein collisions with the molecules. This will make sense if we let epsilon of p, r, and t be p squared over 2m plus u of r. This will then make rho have a time derivative equal to 0. This term will cancel with this. This term will cancel with that. And we'll end up with a time-independent probability. We have now derived from considerations of probability the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for a Brownian particle. We have done it in the presence of Hamiltonian forces and, in addition, in the presence of collisions by molecules. Yes, thank you.
Can we extend this result to where we don't have conservation of the neuron particles? Sort of get the grand partition function?
Yes. Let me think for a moment, because it's not directly this calculation. Okay. Let me tell you how we get there, and that will sort of outline what we're going to be doing over the next lecture. This equation, represents what happens if we talk about one Brownian particle. If we talked about n particles, we would talk about a distribution function, which is n times rho, and we'd have exactly the same equation. Now we have an equation for the distribution function for n big fat particles moving around in a bunch of molecules. The next thing we're going to do is derive what is called the Boltzmann equation. That Boltzmann equation is the time derivative of the distribution function as it is it affected by the collisions among the molecules. We will then get, studying that set of collisions, here are the collisions, a particle with momentum P comes in, bounces off of a particle with momentum Q, produces particles with momentum P prime and Q prime. We will study that, first of all, in the case of classical mechanics. It's not exactly classical mechanics because we're going to be talking about the general scattering probability, and that scattering probability is pretty much defined by quantum mechanics as well as classical mechanics, but at least it is going to be we'll talk about non-degenerate particles. Once we have derived the Boltzmann equation and the equilibrium behavior for these non-degenerate particles, we will then extend this work to talk about particles which obey Fermi-Dirac or Bose-Einstein statistics. That's an easy thing to do. I'll show you how to do it. At first, I thought I wasn't going to do that this year, but the tutors asked me to go talk about particles which obeyed Fermi-Dirac and Bose-Einstein statistics. And I'll at least talk about particles which obey Fermi-Dirac statistics. You got some of the Bose-Einstein statistics when you heard about phonons in the lectures on field theory. So the first thing I'm going to do is derive the Boltzmann equation for the non-degenerate particles. Then I'm going to do the same thing for Fermi-Dirac statistics and derive the different form of the equilibrium distribution functions, which you are derived by these two different kinds of statistics. But let me start out by talking about what goes on in the case of non-degenerate particles. Imagine you have a gas, and you want to go through the same calculation that we just went through for the Brownian particle, but instead of having one big fat particle and lots of little particles, we have particles that are equal to one another, scattering off of one another. Boltzmann looked at collisions of particles, mostly described as moving independently of one another. These particles were described by a Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m plus u of r. But in addition, Boltzmann looked at the effect of the collisions among the particles. That's exactly what we're going to do. Now, what I just went through was a very hairy calculation, a very hard calculation. However, the result is very simple. And I'm going to pick up from this simple result and do stuff which is not equally hairy. Where I'm going to pick up from is that if we have particles moving along with velocity P over M and under a force gradient R of U, the distribution function changes by having the time derivative being P over M, that is the velocity, times the gradient of the distribution function, plus the same term in momentum. Here's the time derivative of the change in momentum times the gradient P of F. Then on the right-hand side, we are going to be talking about the effects of collisions. We're going to look at particle P coming in. Here's the P. Finding another particle around with momentum Q. They come together, bounce off of one another, and come out with different momentum, P prime and Q prime. We are going to be looking at the effect of these collisions. Now, we're not going to do that in a great hairy detail. We will sort of do it in a generalized way. Here's the same picture once again. And what I'm going to say is that the probability that such a collision could occur is first of all proportional to the number of particles around with momentum P, R, and T. Secondly, to the number of particles around with momentum Q at the same point in space, integrated over all momentum Q. Finally, there is a probability that the scattering can happen. That's a probability that P and Q can go into P prime and Q prime. And then we integrate over all of the variables, the momentum of the particle we're scattering off of, the momentum of the states we're scattering into. Here is a representation for the number of scattering events per unit time for a particle at with momentum P at point R and time T. This then describes the scattering event. There, we're also going to think about the scattering event that goes backwards. Particles with momentum Q prime and P prime scatter into states P and Q. This kind of process diminishes the number of particles with momentum P that are around. This kind of process increases the number of particles with momentum P that are around. This kind of process is described by exactly the same expression as this forward scattering. We integrate over Q and P prime and Q prime. The probabilities that we're going to find particles with momentum P prime and Q prime, here's those probabilities, proportional to P prime and Q prime. And then to the scattering rate, which we'll call Q of P prime, Q prime, PQ, just the same thing as here, except written backwards. These two things describe the rates of scattering in the different directions, and now we put it all together. The time derivative of the number of particles with momentum P at position R and time T is given by this stuff produced because you're moving around, produced because you have forces on the particles. Then you have a diminution because you particle with momentum P scatters off of a particle with momentum Q. And you have an increase because particles with momentum P prime and Q prime can scatter into a state with momentum P. These 4 terms, these four terms describe the process that Boltzmann used to define what was going on in a gas. The effects of motion of the particles, the effect of forces on the particles, the effect of scattering out of the state of momentum P, the effect of scattering into the state with momentum P. Scattering out giving you a minus sign, scattering in giving you a plus sign. This is where we're going to start from. Let me see. Where did I start from? I have another. I've gone. This is where we're going to start from next time. The notes have not changed. You can see it again in the notes. This is the process. Go backwards. These are the processes we're going to look at. The scattering events forwards and backwards. The scattering events that take particles out of the state with momentum P, the scattering events that put particles into the state with momentum P. it will not surprise you if I tell you that at the very end of all of this, we have a derivation which gives the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. In fact, this is how Boltzmann derived the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is his enduring contribution to our understanding of processes that go on in nature. We will then generalize this to describe what goes on in at least Fermi-Dirac and probably also Bose-Einstein systems. And then we will have a pretty rich understanding of how time dependence and collisions lead to equilibrium behavior. It's lunchtime, people, but I will field questions before lunch. Questions, comments? Okay, we're going to do lunch now, and next time we pick up on the Boltzmann equation and get equilibrium behavior from it.